from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The sounds of Soweto last night as South Africans gathered to celebrate the life of Nelson Mandela and to mourn his passing. In the next hour of Forum, we'll reflect on his remarkable life, a life dedicated to a set of principles he chose to live by and, as he famously once said, was willing to die for. The life and times of Nelson Mandela, a man who took a brutally divided land and turned it into one nation. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
My name is Nelson Mandela. I look back to the achievements not of individuals, but to the achievements of collective action. A group of men and women, that is the nature of our struggle. Without that struggle, we would still be under apartheid. It is always important to look at your history. You can't really be proud of yourself if you don't know your history.
Nelson Mandela's life, as captured in that montage produced by the BBC, was a singular journey. One that, as President Obama noted yesterday, took him from prison to the presidency. And when he died yesterday at the age of 95, he was perhaps the most admired man of the late 20th and early 21st century. And even though the transformation he sought to achieve in his native land is still far from complete, still the world this morning is focused on just one story, the life and times and legacy of Nelson Mandela. And we will do the same during this hour of Forum. Joining us to do that, Douglas Foster, Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern University and author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Doug Foster, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you, Dave.
Thanks for joining us. Edmund Keller joins us as well, Professor of Political Science at UCLA and former Director of the James S. Coleman African Studies Center at UCLA as well. Professor Keller, good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. And Walter Turner joins us too, chair of the Social Science Department at the College of Marin and host of the Pacifica radio program Africa Today, which airs weekly on KPFA. Walter Turner, good morning as well.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks all for joining us. Douglas Foster, I want to begin with a sentence that you wrote in the op-ed piece that was published by you this morning in the Los Angeles Times, which begins with a quote from a boy you talked to a number of years ago in South Africa, but still many years after Nelson Mandela had ceased to be president, maybe half a dozen, 8 years later after that. And this boy said to you, "Well, isn't Mandela still president?" And I want to ask you about that sense that probably many of us have today, that isn't he still president, that he is in some ways the sort of once and always figure that is beloved by so many. Your thoughts on that?
Sure, you're right. He was, it seems odd to say was to me still a day later, but he was the unifying figure, political figure in a new nation. And I think some expectation, particularly by people in townships and on the streets, in the case of this young man, he was a homeless kid living on the streets in Cape Town, people really understand that the vision that Mandela advocated was to create a new kind of society at the southern tip of Africa, one that was non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, and more egalitarian. And so there was an expectation that 20 years on, political freedom would result in more social and economic justice. And I think that was what this boy Jonathan was reflecting, was, wait a minute, Utata, or the grandfather of the nation, isn't still running things. I would expect to have gone further down this road towards true economic freedom as well as political liberation by now. I think that's what was reflected in his remark.
And Edmund Kellar, do you find yourself reflecting on both this morning, his lasting imprint and legacy, the symbol that he represents for equality, and yet, of course, the still unfinished business that is South Africa?
Absolutely. That's exactly what's on my mind, because it seems to me that in spite of the fact that we've come a long way from the days of apartheid, the journey is not complete, and Mandela would have said that today if he were here, but there's still a high rate of unemployment among blacks. Let's say about 30% of the black population is unemployed as compared to 4% of the white population. Whites still control the economy. There's still a question of land which hasn't been dealt with, and who's to say what's going to happen now that Mandela's gone? Because, in a way, his role was to be considered the father of the nation, which had a salutary effect on any of the groups that operate, either if they supported the government or didn't support the government. Mandela was the kind of figure that could inspire people to put away their differences and think about the future and building a new South Africa.
And Walter Turner, come into this as well, but from the point of view of what he continues to represent in this country. You covered him when he first came here after he was released from prison in 1990, when he came to Oakland. And I'm wondering what you're thinking about this morning, 23 years after that, about what he might still represent to African-Americans here.
You know, it's important to keep it in a larger context. When the events occur in Sharpeville's in the late 1950s, early 1960s, it's the same time when the sit-ins are occurring in Greensboro, North Carolina. So in some senses, there's that synergy between what's going on in South Africa and what African-Americans and other Americans are looking at. When we hosted the event in 1990 in Oakland, the participants were common people. They were church people who had helped build schools. They were people from the United Farm Workers. They were people who saw him as a unifier, not only in terms of South Africa, but globally. And I think in the larger picture, it's important to keep your eyes on what Mandela meant to all of Southern Africa, because in the 1960s, Namibia is not yet free. Angola is not yet free. Zimbabwe is still in the midst of struggles. So I think in some senses, those are our reflections. And for people in the church people and the community people, when he came here in 1990 and 58,000 people turned out, those were the voices who loved and appreciated the unity that Nelson Mandela was bringing.
I want to play a clip now that we've been hearing a lot over the last 24 hours. It's the famous statement from his trial before he was sent off to prison at Robben Island in 1964. And even though it's been played many times, it's worth playing once more.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
Nelson Mandela in 1964, that clip came from the radio documentary by Joe Richmond and Sue Johnson called Mandela, an audio history. Doug Foster, you've heard that many times before, heard it many, many more times over the last 24 hours. I wonder what you find still striking about it as he is about to begin this journey, which would last for 27 years in prison.
Well, it always strikes me, especially when I listen again to Joe and Sue's fine radio documentary, it always strikes me that he's almost daring the judge to sentence the defendants to death. And it was a controversial line that went into his statement, came out, went back in, and which he delivered. So I think of the courage that it took to make that statement, knowing that it might actually push the judge to sentence him to hang. And I also think about the sentence that was actually then came down, which was life in prison for the top leadership of the African National Congress, then banned. And that meant that Nelson Mandela and the other leaders, it was illegal to publish the photograph, to quote them, to publish their names in newspapers. And this kind of severe cutting off of a leader, the eventual leader of the country, had severe long-term effects, of course, on what's possible in South Africa. So I think about that. I reflect on the idea of contingency in history. You know, if he had not survived the 27 years, as so many of his colleagues did not, either as guerrillas in exile or in prison, and how much poorer the world would have been, and how much more difficult the transition in South Africa would have been without him.
And alternatively, Edmund Keller, I wonder if you could also suggest that the other contingency would be that if he had not gone to prison, he might not have become the man he did, that prison was a time apparently when he learned many things about negotiation, about strategy, about leadership, about winning over the white guards that were with him. Was it also, in an odd way, the making of him?
Well, in a way, yes, but Mandela was trying to develop strategies and tactics to tackle the apartheid regime well before he went to prison. And in fact, what he did in prison was to refine those ideas as opposed to just discover them. One of the things that landed him in prison was that the authorities figured that he was allying with some white supporters to try and begin an armed struggle in South Africa, and ultimately he was planning that, but his ideas had begun to take shape quite a while before that.
How would you summarize, Walter Turner, the qualities that when you saw him in 1990, what qualities came through? I'm interested in hearing more about who he was and the kind of qualities that he brought not only to his oratory but to leadership as well.
You know, I think it's key to keep in mind that Mandela really survives a number of different phases, that he certainly from the 1950s to the 1960s, I mean, when he was sent to prison, when he was sent to Robben Island, the goal was that Nelson Mandela wouldn't survive and that his voice would be cut off, whether by him being silenced or whether by him not surviving. And he's very clear, as you in this clip that you played at the beginning, there really was a collective effort. That the ANC was very wise, I think, as Professor Keller is saying, to make sure that Oliver Tambo was situated in England, to make sure that there were alliances with the frontline states, with Tanzania, that the lessons of the recently assassinated Patrice Lumumba were not lost, that there were people in the United States. So I think that that was very important, that he survived those phases of the 1960s. He survived and realized how to build around the Black Consciousness Movement, the United Democratic Front, the Mass Democratic Movement. And when he spoke in Oakland, he was clear that he had come to Oakland because of the role of the Bay Area in the anti-apartheid movement. And when he spoke, he was very clear that 1990 when he was released, was really the beginning of the struggle. And it was very, very true. The next 4 to 5 years were very difficult for the ANC.
We actually have a clip from him from that Oakland speech that you're referencing. So let's listen to that.
It is you, the people of Oakland, the people of the Bay Area, who have given me and my delegation strength and hope to go back and continue the struggle.
Nelson Mandela speaking in Oakland in 1990. Douglas Foster, can you help us understand how it happened that he had the ability to and had the power to negotiate with the white apartheid government when he was released from prison? Was it the support that he had received all around the world, the anti-apartheid movements, the movement to divest if companies were still doing business in South Africa? How did it happen that he was able to meet the leaders of South Africa when he was released from prison and bring about the transformation that he did?
Certainly the movement that William Turner was part of, which was a global movement, a little like the global struggle 100 years earlier to end the slave trade, provided a very powerful lever in the negotiations. The mass uprisings in the cities inside South Africa, huge lever. To a limited extent, the military ability to conduct guerrilla operations, also another lever. I think that the key thing that happened for the leaders, and Mandela in particular, was to begin to think in the 1980s that it might still be possible to come to power, as Mark Maharaj, the old Mandela friend, said, the Castro way. But that the risk of holding out that hope and holding to that strategy would be that they would inherit rubble. And so I think this pivot, which Mandela is very careful to keep reminding us not to see it as a singular pivot by one person, but as a result of consultation and collective decision making, to take this calculated risk that negotiations, which took more than 3 years to lead to an election, that it was worth the risk to do that in order to avoid the risk that the ANC and the Liberation Forces would have political legitimacy, but not the military power to drive the minority white regime out.
Let's listen next to an excerpt from his inauguration speech in 1994 when he was elected president of South Africa. Just a brief excerpt from that speech.
The time for the healing of the wounds has come. The moment to bridge the chasms that divide us has come. We enter into a covenant that we shall build the society in which all South Africans, both black and white, will be able to walk tall without any fear in their hearts, assured of their inalienable right to human dignity, a rainbow nation at peace with itself and the world.
The rainbow nation, Edmund Kellar, that famous phrase. And as Douglas Foster was suggesting, part of it, it sounds like, was not just a question of that he had this benevolence towards the whites of South Africa, but also a matter of strategy, that he didn't want to have the land turned into rubble. What is your sense of that, that his ability to reconcile was both moral but also strategic?
Absolutely, it was strategic, because what he understood was that at the time, whites controlled the economy. They controlled all of the levers of power within South Africa, social, economic, and political. And any sort of effort to sort of totally smash that without including whites was going to be disastrous for the future of the country. You know, what we haven't seen in South Africa – is white flight of any significance, in the sense that, you know, the economy is still as strong as it ever was, and probably it has grown in terms of strength relative to the rest of Africa since the change, in the sense that white South African investors are all over the continent now, investing in banks and real estate deals and other kinds of activities. And, you know, Mandela had a sense that in order to keep relative calm within the country, he was going to have to try to figure out a way to keep whites committed to being South African and building this new society, and I think he achieved that.
Edmund Keller, professor of political science at UCLA. Joining us this hour as we reflect on the life and times of Nelson Mandela, along with Walter Turner and Douglas Foster. We welcome your participation, too. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website about Nelson Mandela, what he might have meant to you, and how you look at him on this day after his passing. Doug Foster, how much can he be held accountable for not more progress being made, that rainbow nation in terms of economic disparities being resolved, that not more progress was made during his time as president, or that he could have shepherded more in the time after he departed?
Boy, that's a hard question for a day like today. But, you know, there was nobody more critical of Nelson Mandela than Nelson Mandela. He held himself to a very high standard. He often said after he left the presidency in 1999 that if he ended up in the other place, as he called it, instead of heaven, it would be because he failed to respond adequately to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And I think it's important just to note that that global capitalism and that pandemic arrived virtually on the same day with democracy, presenting very severe challenges that could not have been predicted in closing the gap and moving more quickly to that vision of a non-racial, non-sexist, and more egalitarian society. So I don't think you give him a pass any more than he would give himself a pass, but I think we also have to understand what the circumstances have been in the last 20 years that made it objectively, structurally, difficult to move more quickly.
Douglas Foster, associate professor at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. We are going to take a short break. When we return, we'd like to hear your thoughts as well at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email them to us as well at forum@kqed.org or post them on our Facebook page or website. What did Nelson Mandela mean to you? What can he still mean, not only to South Africa, but to the world and to this country? We'd welcome your thoughts as we continue our conversation with Douglas Foster, Edmund Keller, and Walter Turner. And I'll read another quote as we take our break for him about the journey that still must lie ahead in terms of overcoming poverty. He said, "Overcoming poverty is not a gesture of charity. It's an act of justice. It's the protection of a fundamental human right, the right to dignity and decent life. While poverty persists, there is no true freedom. The steps that are needed from the developed nations are clear." We'll talk more about that journey that still lies ahead and the life and times of Nelson Mandela when we return. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. A little bit of the South African national anthem as we continue our journey through the life of Nelson Mandela, who passed away yesterday, of course, at the age of 95. We want you to join our conversation, too. You can do so at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's hear first from Phil in San Francisco. Phil, go ahead.
Yeah, I was in Oakland when Mandela came, and I'm a Native American, Mescalero, and Yaqui Indian, and the Indians in full dress came up to Mandela, but they wouldn't let him go through, but he flagged them to go through. And they gave him a note. And when he went to the Coliseum, he said that he didn't want to get involved in the internal affairs of countries, but he felt that he had to mention what was on that note because it reminded him of his people in Africa. And I thought this was kind of important, but nobody has mentioned it on TV or on the radio, and I just wanted to know. It's important to me. It was very important to me that he spoke on it. Is it important?
Phil, thank you. Thanks for telling us that story. Walter, why don't you take that?
Yeah, it was very important. If you listen to the speech of Mandela, which was given on that day, which was maybe close to about 20 minutes, I think there were a couple things that were important. One, behind them on the stage were youth and Vukani Muwethu Choir. It really was a celebration. I think, secondly, it really wasn't a celebrity event. Obviously, the congressional people were there, and Ron Dellums was there, who had been very active, and Barbara Lee. But generally, it was a people's event. And Mandela was so very basic and very warm when he said that he made this part of his speech, that had he had more time, he would have been able to visit with Native Americans who were there. Native American dancers and musicians, along with Africans, were part of the procession. But he was very, very sincere that that is something that he wanted to do. And that was the tone that he brought. In fact, he says, I'm an old man, but being here today makes me feel young. And he broke into a smile. And so he was very, very happy, and for good reason, particularly in the Bay Area.
Phil, thanks. Thanks for bringing that to our program this morning. Let's talk a little bit more about what he inspired in this country. And to start us in that direction, let's hear from what the president had to say yesterday.
I am one of the countless millions who drew inspiration from Nelson Mandela's life. My very first political action, the first thing I ever did that involved an issue or a policy or politics, was a protest against apartheid.
It's interesting to think about that, Edmund Kellar, that's what engaged the president in political action. As we are talking about the legacy of Nelson Mandela, put that part of his legacy in perspective. The effect that he had and the rally against apartheid had on people in this country, because you make the argument, I suppose, in some ways, that the protest movement against apartheid, the desire to have universities and cities and divest from any company that invested in South Africa, was in some ways you could say one of the most successful protest movements that this country has seen in recent times.
Absolutely. You know, it seems to me that we have to consider what happened in South Africa around the time that Nelson Mandela was in prison, the initial days, that is, to what was going on in the world. You know, most of Africa was gaining its gaining independence from European colonial rule. The civil rights movement had taken place in the United States. And in a way, people around the world were becoming more and more politically conscious and more committed to the idea of equality and justice. And Nelson Mandela ended up being sort of the focal point of those kinds of ideas. And in fact, that inspired a lot of young people. First of all, I can remember, like in the early 1970s, there was all this fervor about Kodak film company getting out of South Africa, Gulf Oil getting out of Namibia and so forth and so on, and Angola. And that sort of dovetailed with what was happening among youth who began to champion the cause of freedom and independence, and Nelson Mandela, because he'd been in prison for such a while, became an icon, a symbol of what that was all about. Getting Nelson Mandela out of prison became the objective of organizations like TransAfrica and the student movements and so forth and so on. And, you know, a lot of us, you know, had our introduction to international politics pretty much at that time.
Right. It's interesting to also think about, Douglas Foster, that it's a reminder of what's possible with student protest, or not just student protest, but protest in general and popular action. I had to be reminded, I'd forgotten, that Congress actually overrode Reagan's veto in terms of new investment in South Africa. It's interesting to think about in this paralyzed time of ours, what Mandela actually inspired.
Yeah, I think during a period where we're turning away from politics, formal politics anyway, really important to see the connection between a half a century struggle for equal rights in the U.S. and in the late stages of that struggle, leaders and activists in it from the bottom up. Seeing a connection between freedom in Chicago, in San Francisco, in all parts of the United States and the North, U.S. and Europe, with freedom in Johannesburg, Cape Town, Durban, and the rest. And I think that really is an epiphany that is worth having again today, because, of course, many of the constraints placed on the ability to move towards a more egalitarian society in South Africa come back to trading rules and the rest, which limit the ability of developing countries to produce those kinds of manufacturing jobs that allow a government like the current government in South Africa to move more people out of poverty and into middle-income status. So I think that the lessons of that anti-apartheid struggle and of what's been achieved so far is that it's not just up to the South Africans. It's up to the rest of us who care about the success of that experiment in democracy to pay more attention and to make some decisions on this side that create more space for gaining traction.
And indeed, one could argue to focus more on income disparity and inequality in this country, as the president spoke to the day before Mandela died.
Well, there you go. I mean, the very last time I saw Mandela after the World Cup in 2010, I walked into the room with my son, and he said he was a very puckish, kind of mischievous person. And he often would make a little joke at the beginning of any encounter. And so he said to us, it's very interesting that these young people keep coming around to see a very old man who has nothing new to say. And, of course, we all laughed. But there was a needle in that joke, of course, as there often was with him, which was to say, while you're, keeping track of how far things were taken in my lifetime of struggle, what have you done? And what are you going to do tomorrow to move the world closer to this vision of a non-racial, non-sexist, more egalitarian place?
To Marie, next in San Francisco. Marie.
I had a question. I also just want to comment on what an amazing, not only peacemaker he was, but actor as well, in Shawshank Redemption and Bruce Almighty. But to achieve greatness in both realms is amazing. But also, how can kids relate presently?
I think you're thinking about the actor who played Mandela in the 2010 movie, not Mandela himself. But go ahead.
Well, how can kids relate to him presently? Never mind.
That's okay. I appreciate the question, Maria. I think you're talking about the actor who played both in Shawshank Redemption and Mandela in Invictus. But to her question about how kids can relate to it, it would seem like Edmund Kellar, part of the answer is in what Doug Foster just said about the relevance of that message today in our own country.
Absolutely. I think, more and more as we become a global society, as communications becomes more easy from one culture to the next. I think a lot of folks are going to sort of latch on to the kinds of things that bring us closer together as opposed to driving us further apart. You know, it's kind of interesting. What I wanted to say about the timing of the movement against the apartheid government throughout the world occurred at a time when we had gone through the civil rights movement here, the reason we were able to change the situation was because our constitution guaranteed equal rights. Whereas in South Africa, what was being built by the apartheid government was a constitution that was anathema to equal rights. And, of course, that struck a lot of people in the sense that it mobilized them against the entrenchment of such a regime. And surely, I think there's a connection, with the progressive trends that took place.
You know, I think it's important to also keep in mind that Nelson Mandela's vision, Madiba's vision, was not just about South Africa, but it was about all of the African continent. He showed that after he came to office in 1994. But it's also very sobering to note that two things. Certainly that the ANC was part of a tripartite alliance, which involved the South African Communist Party and the Congress of South African Trade Union. But around the same time that he was elected in 1994 was almost the same moment that the genocide was occurring in Rwanda, that the people that Nelson Mandela reached out to first wouldn't have necessarily been people who may have those who were friends or wanted to be friends of the new South Africa would have thought would have been the most appropriate allies, meaning Fidel Castro in mm-hmm. the country of Cuba, traveling to Libya, becoming involved in issues around Rwanda and around Lesotho. And if you look at despite the claims about the tremendous growth rates that you see on the African continent, excepting for those countries and inclusive of those who are large traders of extractive resources, Africa and people and children have found the last going, I think this is the point that Doug made, a very, very difficult, it's a very, very difficult time, very different time from 1990 to the world that we're looking at here in 2010 and measuring the legacy of Mandela.
Walter Turner, chair of the Social Science Department at the College of Marin, also hosts Africa Today, which airs weekly on KPFA here in San Francisco. Max in Berkeley joins us next. Max, go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for an outstanding program, and thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. If we look at Algeria and South Africa, the two countries selected the different approaches to solving a very difficult problem. Or set of problems. And I would like you to explain the difference between the two approaches. In Algeria, there was a clear break made. In South Africa, a more conciliatory approach was taken. It's too early to pass judgment on the results, of course. But I would like you to discuss for me what informed this sort of difference in approaches. And then lastly, very quickly, I just finished reading a beautiful piece about Mandela and his wife. I'd like you to talk about his last phase of his life in partnership with Gracia Marshall. Thank you very much.
Max, thanks for the calls. Let's do the difficult one. Well, they're actually the latter one has its own complexities too. But on Algeria, Douglas Foster, can you tackle that?
Well,
A little bit. I'm not expert on the Algeria situation, but I do think that that pivotal point that we were talking about a little bit earlier, in which key leaders, certainly people also on the ground in South Africa in the late 80s, thought that it might be possible to make the country ungovernable for long enough and to launch limited guerrilla activities in a way that eventually might be able to drive out the white regime totally militarily, as they said, the Castro way. But there was this recognition about the potential cost. Certainly, they were studying not only in prison but in exile and in Umkhonto Sizwe, the guerrilla wing of the party, the experiences in other African countries, the experiences of other national liberation movements. Some of the major backers, financial backers, and armed backers of the ANC, the Soviet Union, had unraveled and was in the process of withdrawing aid. So there were many practical and strategic considerations to take this leap, and it was a considerable leap, to think that you could negotiate your way to freedom.
Edmund Kellery, I'm going to give you a talk show guest choice. You can either say something more about Algeria or you can tackle Nelson Mandela's third marriage.
Yeah, I do want to say something about Algeria. What you have to understand is that at the time that Algeria gained its independence, for sure it went through a seven-year revolutionary struggle, but it was still a colonial possession of France. Whereas in South Africa gained its independence from Britain in 1910. The whites who make up the core of the South African white population arrived in South Africa in the 17th century, and they felt and continue to feel they are just as much indigenous to Africa as the black Africans are, you know, the conditions were different. The way France pulled out, of course, it pulled out. There were only about, 8% of the population controlled 90% of the land, which 8% being the French. And the Africans, once the French pulled out, the Africans could then establish their society on the basis which they chose. But in South Africa, it was much more tricky.
Yeah.
And it had to do with the white settler population and also the fact that South Africa had been an independent country since 1910.
I want to convert to Max's question about Mandela's third marriage a bit and ask you, Walter Turner, or Doug Foster, you can weigh in on this too, to respond to this email. Keeping in mind his happy third marriage, Art writes, I work for Peace Creations, which is a group that works on reducing domestic violence. Nelson Mandela is a beacon to me in this work. I remember that he was someone who grew as an advocate for that. But in his own domestic life, that was also a struggle for him. So can you address his family struggles? Walter Turner, you have anything you want to add on that?
That's probably a better question for my friend Doug. Let me pick up on one piece that Professor Keller was saying, and I think it's important to note that France had just been defeated in the Vietnam. This is post-World War II period, and it's impossible to go through Africa and put stamps on countries. Mandela is very fortunate. We're very fortunate he was able to survive. When he was in prison, he had tuberculosis. He had a prostate. He was losing his sight. He lost his son. He lost his mother, who he could never visit. His relationship with Winnie was made very, very public and very, very personal. And in some senses, when you hear Mandela, when he says that phrase, I'm willing to die for, he's not saying that just about the struggle, but that he's putting himself out there really as a beacon of hope, as a driver of dreams for everybody on the continent. And you pay a price for that, and that's a price that he paid.
Was he happy in the end, Doug Foster? He seems to have had this happy last marriage, and yet, of course, we read about the various family arguments that were taking place even during this very last part of his life.
He was definitely, if you walked into the room and you were with the old man, as everybody refers to him on that side of the water, and Grasse Machel walked into the room, his eyes lit up. He sat up a little bit straighter. He flirted. This is a man who knew how to take risks late in life. He married her at the age of 80. And I think that, the problems and stresses within the family, particularly in the last couple of years, are understandable. The patriarch was away for 27 years. The minute he came out of prison, he had enormous demands placed on him all over the world. And I think the person who's written this email gets at something very important, which is often overlooked, and that is the tremendous price that was paid by the lovers and the friends and the family of those leaders, but also ordinary people in the struggle who made enormous sacrifices. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people made enormous sacrifices and sacrificed personal lives. So in a very touching foreword that Mandela wrote to a book called Shades of Difference by Padraig O'Malley, he had this haunting phrase in there which said that after he came out of prison, he realized that he couldn't dance to the same rhythm as his children and his then-wife, Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and grandchildren. And I think that that's worth noting today, that the price that was paid not only by the individual, but by the people around them in ways that don't often get discussed or get adequate tribute paid to them. As much as the differences within the family have been amplified in the last year, there are a lot of, there are children here and grandchildren who yearned for a closer relationship with father and grandfather, and really only had that chance in the last couple of years.
Hmm. Douglas Foster, author of After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Martha writes, in 1990, John Hockenberry interviewed the singer Miriam Makeba about the transition and Mandela's release from prison. I remember that she was happy, and yet she also said that the road for South Africa was long and that a key part would be the increase of status and respect for South African women. So thank you, panelists, for reminding us that the goal was more than dismantling apartheid. Rather, it was building a society that was non-sexist as well as non-racist. I want to play one last comment from the conclusion of President Obama's remarks yesterday as a way of setting up the last part of our conversation. Here's President Obama.
The day he was released from prison gave me a sense of what human beings can do when they're guided by their hopes and not by their fears. And like so many around the globe, I cannot fully imagine my own life without the example that Nelson Mandela set. And so long as I live, I will do what I can to learn from him.
Such an interesting thought, Walter Turner, the president saying yesterday, as long as he will live, he'll try to learn from him. What do you think we should try to learn from Nelson Mandela?
Oh, there's so much. I mean, there's so much more work to be done in on the African continent in terms of countries that are developing. I think one of the things that impresses me is the way that Nelson Mandela always made sure that it wasn't singular. He was able to navigate through the eras of the black consciousness, but also when he was at the verge of being released, he said that, I'm not going to walk out until the people who are in worse health, who are in worse conditions than I, are able to walk out. And I thought that was really resonate. And when he was in Oakland, he was just so very humble. The comment that the listener mentioned about Native Americans, I mean, it was something that he was reading off of a piece of paper, but it was clear that he wanted to say that. He wanted people to know that he cared. And I think that's absolutely crucial. So I think those are the things, those human qualities, that ability to rise above a lot of different circumstances, to be there and to be consistent and to do it with love. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission, for where it worked and where it didn't work, it's certainly become a model for countries who come through the psychological horror that apartheid was and what South Africa was for more than many decades in Africa. I think that's very, very important that he wanted to do that. He wanted there to be healing, and he wanted there to be healing for everyone. And that's something we can all learn from.
Walter Turner. Edmund Keller and Doug Foster, we're quite short on time. So Edmund Keller first, a last thought on what you have learned from him.
Well, you know, I think that Mandela set the standard when it comes to respect for human rights and sort of fighting for causes that are just and that protect and advance the cause of human rights. And I think I will remember that most about him. Hmm. He was larger than life, and there won't be another person like that for quite a time to come. If Obama approaches that, I'd be happy.
Yeah. Douglas Foster, a last quick thought, please.
I most political leaders spend their entire careers trying to convince us of their indispensability. I think the great gift that Nelson Mandela gave his people in the last 10 years was preparing people so carefully, consciously, intentionally, and making the case that he was dispensable, that this experiment, democratic experiment, would thrive without him. And I think what we're about to see will make that promise true.
Douglas Foster, joining us along with Edmund Keller and Walter Turner. Thanks all very much for joining us in this conversation about the life and times of Nelson Mandela. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engagement producer, Amanda Supai. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.